Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren Deanne Schulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we have an extreme distributed ops version of this again. I guess we've actually done this last time we were distributed for the anniversary episode as well. I'm in Kansas City. Radha, where are you? Are you at home in San Francisco?
I am at home in San Francisco.
And I'm in Washington, D.C., as you know, where I normally am.
I think it's an open question, like, which is, like, snowy and icier at the moment. Kansas City is a complete skating rink, and so it's been great fun walking to cars and scraping ice off of cars while also trying to, like, not fall down and break your elbow. So, needless to say, I'm not drinking anything at the moment. I've got to go to the airport here in a little bit. Is anybody else drinking anything exciting?
I am. I have some hot chocolate that I added some vanilla bourbon to that my mother made. Which is kind of exciting.
That's awesome.
Your mother made vanilla bourbon?
Well, I mean, the bourbon was pre-made and she added vanilla to it. Yeah.
Well, that sounds very tasty. I'm drinking ginger ale, but in fairness, that's to wash down the cinnamon Pop-Tarts that I scarfed down before we started recording. So does that make it better?
Breakfast of champions. Yes, indeed. Before we get started, I hope everyone enjoyed the Manniversary episode last time. And we, you know, we do a very poor job encouraging folks to rate and review us on iTunes or Spotify, where you can now find our podcast, or any number of other hosting services. So if you love Bombshell, and we think you all do, please tell the rest of the world and give us a rating and review. It helps other people find us. It helps other people realize how awesome all of us and all of our fans are.
And we are at 99 written reviews on iTunes right now. So if you want to be a special number 100, it's just waiting for you.
You could get right in there and get on that. So we have this week a very special guest, Paula Garcia-Tufro. Hi, Paula.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
Paula, you're the deputy director of the Adrian Arsh Latin America Center at the Atlantic Council. Is that right?
That's right.
Awesome. So we are going to talk to you in just a minute about Venezuela. That was one of, Radha wanted to talk more about Venezuela this year, and we realized that we were all completely unqualified to do so. So we're excited to have a guest to help us explore those topics. But first, we need to do the bombshell questions.
So the first one, if you could pitch a show or series to Netflix, what would it be?
So I had a hard time with this one, I'm not going to lie. Bear with me with the wonkiness of my response. So I've long been on a crusade along with many other international development experts to try to make it clearer to a broader set of both the U.S. population and elsewhere of why foreign assistance, why development matters, and why it matters for not only now, but for future generations. So if we do a series that would that could actually hammer that home and actually get more people on board for why this matters, I think that would be a huge win.
Oh, like that cooking series, but instead of cooking, it would be development, you know, with the woman, salt, fat, whatever.
We're going to need to do some work on the casting. We're going to need like Arnie Hammer, or I don't know if Angelina Jolie, maybe in her like UNICEF role, will be willing to do this. But I think we're going to need to kick that up a notch and get some really excellent cast members. Paula, what do you follow like a sport that is not a sport?
So I actually have heard some of your previous podcasts, and I'm afraid I'm going to pile on with some others, because in addition to kind of the not so fun response in terms of, not surprisingly, I follow politics and foreign affairs, it's gossip magazines, Us Weekly, and in particular the Royals. So I know some of your previous guests have said I'm slightly obsessed, slightly embarrassed to admit that, but alas, I just have on a podcast.
I'm a real sucker for the town and country coverage of the Royals, which is incredibly breathless and a little ahistorical, but it really fills a particular sugary need in my media consumption diet.
It may or may not be true that my news feed on Google pops up articles about Royals fashion in addition to regular news as like suggested for you. So it's fine.
Just get through the day any way you can.
Exactly. Exactly.
Who is your fictional or literary hero?
All right, so I cheated a bit here. I'm going with non-fictional, and I am going with Mandela. And there's a longer story of some of my background, but in particular, the link back to social justice, democracy, and his commitment to nonviolence, at least certainly in the early days, is a thread that has run through both my personal and professional career. So I've I'm going to cheat a bit and go with nonfiction. Making my own adventure here.
All right, last question. What is your favorite algorithm?
All right, so I've got a favorite and a least favorite. So favorite is autocorrect. Least favorite is this whole autocomplete thing that has picked up traction. Gets a little bit too far ahead of me, and it's a little bit dangerous, and hitting send a little too fast. It makes you have to be way more aware about what just got written for you.
I don't like autocomplete on the desktop Gmail, but I kind of love the pre-populated responses on the iPhone app. So, you know.
I have this dream of someday, like, just every single email I respond to is just going to be whatever the third suggested response is. Not the first or second, but the third. It's like picking wines, the third cheapest bottle, and just like see how my day goes. I feel like it could be a real adventure.
We can always tell when someone in our office is using autocomplete because he has a thing against using exclamation points in emails. He thinks it should not be done in a professional setting. But,
but Gmail thinks it's great.
Gmail loves it. So just pretty constantly it's like, thanks so much, exclamation point, and like, I know what you're doing.
All right. Well, we're going to have to shift gears to slightly more serious topics here and hope you can help us kind of walk through Venezuela. So, you know, there's basically been a crisis in Venezuela for most of the last several years, but it's really picked up in the news here in the last month or so. And so I'm wondering, Paula, if you can kind of just bring us up to speed on what has, where, you know, how we've gotten to this particular point, and then we can move into some of the questions about U.S. policy that are both contributing to it and how we might respond.
Sure. I think one of the first things I would start with is that it's kind of a three-pronged crisis that Venezuela, that's unfolding in Venezuela. One is that there's a constitutional crisis underway. There's two claims to the presidency. Obviously, Nicolas Maduro is claiming that he is still the legitimate president of Venezuela. And you've got an interim president, Representative Juan Guaido from the opposition, who has staked a claim in an interim capacity anchored in the Constitution. We'll go a little bit into more greater detail on that, but let me just, so constitutional crisis, humanitarian crisis, which is having implications, dire implications on the ground in Venezuela, as well as having increasingly regional implications on neighboring countries who are absorbing these Venezuela migrants. And third, there's an economic crisis, which, as you noted, has been building for some time. And you know, we can talk through some of the numbers of that economic decline we've seen just during Maduro's first term. So maybe take a step back, start with the beginning, with the first one, constitutional crisis. President Maduro, or Nicolas Maduro, took over the presidency in 2013 after Chavez passed away. He was kind of the hand-selected successor. He's now served a full term. That full first term wrapped up at the end on January 10th. When he was due to be sworn in for a second term. That second term would have been the result of the presidential elections that were held in 2018. They were held in May. They were widely believed to be fraudulent elections by the international community. And so effectively what that triggered was on that January 10th day when Maduro was expecting to be sworn in, which he's technically supposed to do before the National Assembly, which is controlled by the opposition, you had the opposition actually draw upon the constitutional, a clause in the Constitution that says if there isn't a legitimate president or there isn't a president that can serve in that capacity based on the constitutional order, that the head of the National Assembly becomes the interim president pending new elections. So that was the clause that they latched onto, and they invoked that their standing as or his standing, Juan Guaido's standing as the interim president.
And so the U.S. has actually been somewhat successful in getting our partners and allies globally to follow our lead, or follow at least our move on recognizing Guaido as the interim leader. That at least kind of caught me by surprise, and seems like there might have been a fair amount of diplomacy behind that. Was that surprising to you, or was that something that had been brewing for a little while?
I mean, certainly it's surprising to the extent that it's a bit of an outlier in terms of how this administration has pursued diplomatic relations in other arena. So the fact that there was, you know, the traditional work of diplomacy behind the scenes around the January 10th and around the January 23rd actual invoking of that clause of the Constitution by the opposition is somewhat surprising. on the other hand, it's not entirely surprising in the sense of there had been a growing coalition of like-minded partners, not only European, but within the region in Latin America, a general alignment for some time that behind this opposition to Nicolas Maduro, and frankly, a desire to have some coordinated action to address both the economic crisis and the growing humanitarian crisis. And in particular, that coordinated support grew as the humanitarian crisis got more and more dire, and as those spillover effects started really affecting regional stability and individual countries.
And so let me shift gears a little bit to talk about some of that coordinated action and its impact on economic conditions, because obviously there's been a massive economic, I mean, what could largely be described as a collapse with hyperinflation and GDP slowing. At sort of towards the end of January, the U.S. imposed sanctions on the state-owned oil firm, basically saying that the Venezuelan oil should be withheld from the Maduro government and the company could avoid the sanctions by recognizing Guaido. So I'm just wondering how much the oil conditions and those types of sanctions are making it worse, or whether pressuring the sort of state-owned oil companies are something that we would expect to see, and we think that's moving in the right direction to try to get greater internal recognition in the political sense, and sort of if you were surprised to see this kind of overlap between economic and political pressure points.
So I'd say, number one, the sanctions are designed to deprive the Maduro regime of key revenue stream. The oil revenue represents the bulk of the Venezuelan government's revenue stream and has for a long time. It's both, you know, what revenue they have to sustain, you know, even in its smaller scale economic production of oil and other resources, but also it's what's sustaining, quite frankly, the system of corruption across the border and buying of loyalty. So Maduro has long sustained himself in power by virtue of creating a system that rewards political loyalty. So that's the core objective of those sanctions. I think in terms of the impact that it's having, it's certainly serving that purpose right off the bat in terms of depriving Maduro of that key revenue. The initial steps the U.S. government took, as you said, froze those assets overseas. So effectively, without preventing the Venezuelan state-owned oil company from actually selling to the U.S., what they said is, you can keep selling, but whatever revenues we're going to pay into this blocked account, and we're not going to send them back, and ultimately signaled that they would ultimately want to redirect those resources to the opposition and the interim government. But the other thing I would say is it absolutely is going to have a negative impact on the humanitarian situation, because it is putting a strain on the conditions on the ground, where there's already significant shortages of food, medicines, and basically all basic goods. So it cuts both ways.
So building off the humanitarian situation, I am grateful to some of my students who proposed a project last semester on the Venezuelan refugee issue. And this, I say grateful to them because despite refugees being a really prominent international news story worldwide over the last couple of years, I was completely ignorant of the number of refugees who have departed Venezuela and the potential for the growth of the refugee population coming out. And I wondered if you might just go into, first of all, some of the numbers, but also how that is impacting the region around Venezuela, particularly some of the political dynamics that may be impacting how others are reacting to Maduro and the possibility of Guaido coming into power.
Sure. So, I mean, the scale is extraordinary. There's already been more than 3.3 million migrants who have left Venezuela and have relocated to a variety of countries, in particular around the region, but some have gone to Europe and elsewhere. Just to break down those numbers, Colombia has received over 1 million Venezuelan migrants. Ecuador has received more than 700,000. Chile has received more than 200,000, Brazil 100,000, the U.S. 500,000. I recently heard a stat which I think makes the point. So even the Caribbean islands of Aruba and Curaçao, if you take it as not as an absolute number, but you look at the percentages, 10% of the population of Aruba now is made up of Venezuelan migrants. 15% of the population of Curaçao is now Venezuelan migrants.
Oh, my goodness.
And just again, just to break down the numbers in a different way, there's 5,000 people leaving daily. That's 200 people an hour. 13% of the Venezuelan population has now left Venezuela. And so just to turn to the second part of your question in terms of what that means for those countries who are absorbing those migrants and taking them in, I think we've seen extraordinary generosity in terms of the neighboring countries. But I think what we're seeing now as those numbers have grown is that it really is putting a strain on local capacity, both in terms of the fiscal impacts of actually taking these folks in, providing services, housing them, providing them access to healthcare, food, medicine, and just frankly, their safety nets are just, they're at their breaking point. And I think it's also, you know, as those numbers have grown, you've seen what's gone from extraordinary generosity to some issues related to security, but, and frankly, some of it is more perceived. There's been some isolated examples of, you know, isolated to varying degrees of some xenophobia and some backlash to the growing number of Venezuelans. I was in Colombia, you know, last fall, and whilst Colombia has been incredibly generous, I think there had been a movement towards, you know, people want to be generous up until their park on their street corner or near their house is now an encampment. And then people start to get a little bit nervous. So I think as the strain on local capacity to absorb kids in schools, provide health services, provide housing for all these people has hit kind of their limits, you're starting to see more of a pushback on the population, which is, you know, both a shame, a challenge, and something that obviously these countries are working through on a daily basis. And the rest of the international community has mobilized significant resources, but obviously not enough. The U.S. For humanitarian purposes, the U.S. has committed $20 million. Canada recently committed $53 million. You know, we've all been seeing images over the last couple of days of the U.S. having shipped some of that assistance to Colombia and a few other distribution points. But primarily, we've seen kind of a showdown on the Colombian border with significant assistance kind of piled up on one side of the bridge on the Colombian side. And Maduro has made very clear that he's not going to accept that assistance and has actually blockaded the main bridge that connects that border. So it's incredibly tense on the ground. The numbers are staggering. There's no end in sight. So I cited the figure of 3.3 migrants to date. The expectation is that 2 million more will leave before the end of this year. So it's, you know, as the situation drags on in terms of the constitutional crisis, that humanitarian crisis is growing and will continue to do so.
So how do we make sense of U.S. policy at this moment, Paula? Obviously, we talked about the recognition of Guaido as the, you know, leader of the interim government. Rada mentioned the shift in sort of sanctions policy and, you know, really trying to adjust those revenue streams. More broadly, I mean, you hear kind of in Washington and in some of, you know, some reporting that there's considerations of some military options or contingencies. That always strikes me as both sort of, you know, literally fantastic until, I mean, I don't mean that in, like, it sounds great. I mean, it sounds sort of fanciful, but stranger things have happened. What's your sense of kind of where the U.S. policy discussion is, given that we've recognized this interim government and we have sort of this now like standoff with the Maduro government?
I mean, I'd say a few things, right? One of the things that jumps out about this situation, and it's an inconsistency that's often pointed out, is that the way that the U.S. government has framed its initial support for Guaido around its support for democracy and a you know, democratic movement, it's an outlier. It's not consistent with how this administration has necessarily responded to other challenges in other parts of the world. So that stands out. I think in terms of other reasons why the U.S. is you know, is particularly focused here is it's in our hemisphere. You know, it's unfortunately you know, drawing on the, you know, there's been, they've cited the Monroe Doctrine, and they're drawing on a long and frankly sordid history of U.S. Interventions gone wrong in the region. So it's triggering some concerns from that regard. But certainly the question of regional stability as a result of both the economic collapse and the humanitarian situation is another element of why it's relevant to the U.S. And obviously there's oil impacts, but I think that, you know, that story that it's, you know, because of oil assets that the U.S. cares is overplayed, to say the least. I think in terms of the question of military intervention, it's really interesting because I get this question all the time in terms of, you know, is it real or is it not the threat? And from my perspective, it's frankly not that it's only relevant to a point whether it's real or not. I think certainly the Trump administration has used the threat of potential for intervention to increase pressure in the hopes that it will lead to some fissures within the core pillars of support for the Maduro regime, and that's in the armed forces. You know, the U.S., as we started talking about, has actually done a pretty good job in this case of working with the international community on the diplomatic front, and I think, you know, the real besides the potential, we could talk at length about the wisdom of actually intervening militarily and how that would play out. But I think more relevant is that, you know, this coalition of aligned countries in the region and around the world starts to fray really quickly once you start talking about military intervention. And, you know, Latin American countries and Europe and the UN and any number of countries, other countries, have all stated that they do not support military intervention by the U.S. or otherwise. So it would break down, it would create a rift where there's been good coordination on the diplomatic front. And I think that that's a tremendous concern, in particular with as it relates to Latin American countries.
For sure. Well, I mean, I think you've given us a great overview of this problem, but obviously we've only just scratched the surface. So I hope we have a chance to revisit this as things improve, although that has not been the trajectory in Venezuela here for quite some time. So, Paula, thank you so much for joining us and getting us smart on a very complicated topic.
Thank you so much for having me.
Shall we keep up some foreign relations?
I believe we have some greatest hits to return to this week.
We really do. I mean, a couple of these we haven't maybe done in depth in a while, but we are going to start with Brexit, which continues to be the gift that keeps on giving. I could say that like both a lot has happened with Brexit since the last time we probably talked about it. And at the same time, nothing has changed. So Theresa May has survived.
Well, there's less time.
Yes, that is the main thing that's changed, is that the Brits are really looking down the barrel on their hard Brexit, which will come at the end of March. But Theresa May has survived a no confidence vote. She survived a leadership challenge in December. Her plan was presented to Parliament and pretty thoroughly rejected. There's going to be a debate this week, February 14th. But probably not a vote, although the members of parliament are promised a quote-unquote meaningful vote, which I love to distinguish from possibly all the unmeaningful votes they've had the opportunity to make, but basically before the end of February. But man, time's running out.
Yeah, and just to put a finer point on the time point, come February, well, February 8th has come and gone, which is when stuff that was leaving by ship from the UK and heading to places like Australia and New Zealand will get there after Brexit based on typical shipping timelines. And towards the end of February is when, really February 17th, I think is the target date from the Brits, is when ships going to Asia and in particular Japan may arrive after Brexit. So the ships are leaving with stuff, but not necessarily knowing what the customs order they will face when the ships arrive in port. So that's a fun adventure for everyone on the seas.
Do you guys remember before the referendum, there was like this weird faux sea battle from Nigel Farage or whatever his name is that they had on the Thames, and like they had this like it was this very strange moment where like, oh, this can't possibly get weirder, and suddenly it has over the last year. Like it's almost quaint to look back on that moment and think like, oh, Brexit, it's so quaint. No, actually this is really effed up.
But it also seems sort of anachronistic, right? This idea that like you would leave port and, you know, not really know what would be waiting for you four weeks later, right?
Right.
Like that seems like a problem from, you know, 1850, not a problem of 2019. But I guess all of the 2019 problems are kind of weird in their own way.
We're retro.
Yeah, well, some of them are retro. Some of them are very modern. Speaking of which, we have some new issues in Iraq. We haven't really talked about Iraq in a while, really. There was, of course, a lot of discussion around ISIS, primarily related to Syria, which we covered in December. And we'll probably come back to that in an upcoming episode because no one really is yet sure if we're withdrawing troops from there or not. But that's really more White House mayhem. And under the heading of keeping up foreign relations, there was some interesting Iraq news, although I guess it was made by the president in his Super Bowl interview with Mark Brennan last week. Did you guys follow this?
That we are apparently staying in Iraq. And a base that really doesn't make a whole lot of sense to do so for, you know, helping Iraq purposes, but also just to keep an eye on Iran, even though that, you know, it doesn't really make a lot of sense from a geographic perspective. But hey, geography, who cares?
Well, we're keeping an eye on things generally. I mean, we're looking and watching. We're like Santa Claus.
We're like Elf on the Shelf, like but Claus. From Al-Assad Air Base in Western Iraq.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's right.
Al-Tanf.
This is one of those things where I actually watched the interview, and when I first, you know, I wasn't paying a great deal of attention, and I heard him say it, and I was like, well, I mean, that is probably, you know, what the administration thinks. And then, like, you just wait a beat, and you realize, man, they just can't help but say the quiet part out loud every time, right? Like, that is not the stated reason for being in Iraq. It's not the agreed-to reason with the Iraqi government for why there are American troops there.
And it makes the Iraqis really, really mad for you to say.
Yes, it makes them really mad because they have a completely different relationship with Iran than we do. It's, in fact, way better. So they're not interested. I mean, the former prime minister, Haider al-Abadi, said, you know, quote, you know, we are not here to be proxies in other people's conflicts. It's not part of the strategic framework agreement that we have with the Iraqi government, which is about training Iraqi troops for counterterrorism purposes. And so it definitely gets to, like, you know, if this is all just a ruse and you're spying on Iran from here or staging for, you know, some sort of military activity against Iran, that makes the Iraqi government not just super spooked, but as Lauren says, super mad.
Yeah. And it's a weird, it's A, weird for the president to say, and B, then it puts, like, for example, General Votel, when he's testifying, in a weird place where he's gets asked, like, so are you spying on Iran? And he's like, well, we haven't been given any new taskings. They're like, so follow-up question, that first question we just asked, like, are we there to spy it? Like, it's just this weird, you know, even if it is a ancillary mission, probably, Aaron, to your point, not the one we're supposed to be talking at in our out loud voices in public.
Well, and also not being done from an air base in Western Iraq. I mean, like, that's just ridiculous, like, on its sort of face of
Look, he doesn't know where the air base is. I mean, General Votel, like, does, but President Trump doesn't.
I did have a brief moment of, if the president is indeed saying the quiet part out loud, that he listened at one point to somebody's quiet part, that there was a briefing to him where this was discussed, and he paid enough attention to regurgitate this to Margaret Brennan. And I almost had a moment of, like, good on you. I'm kind of impressed. Because, like, yeah.
Yeah, see, this is why I don't sweat that he doesn't take the presidential daily, you know, decision briefs, because I'm basically fine with us telling him as little classified information as possible for exactly these reasons. So that's the... But it'll be very interesting to see going forward, I mean, if this actually, you know, this sort of drama paralleled with the potential withdrawal from Syria, if that shifts the relationship with the Iraqi government or other elements of the force posture in the region, because people have concerns about this. I think it'll be, it's on the one hand a flub, on the other hand, could be a pretty interesting footnote to a broader shift in the Middle East posture for us.
Yeah, and also internally in Iraqi politics, right? Because it's not entirely,
for sure.
It's not that all of the Iraqi political forces and parties are super gung-ho on Iran, but some of them are not so anti-Iran. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out in their domestic politics too.
So before we escape the Iraq issue, slightly related, did you guys happen to see the testimony that the Assistant Secretary for SOLIC, Special Operations Low-Intensity Conflicts, Owen West, gave earlier last week, where he was asked, first of all, do you understand the strategic rationale for pulling out of Syria? And he quite bluntly said, no, I do not know what it is. I have not been told. And
I did see that
a few times, whether or not Secretary Mattis was right, implying the statements that Secretary Mattis made in his resignation letter. And he said just quite briefly, yes. It's rare that we see the national security apparatus contradict the president in that kind of form. You see it in other ways, usually in the press or just in actions. But in statements to the Senate, that has not been the case thus far. And it just really struck me as a moment of like, this could be, with this new Congress in particular, could be a moment for a lot more pushback as against the president's policies by his national security team, particularly on the Hill.
I think it'd be very interesting, especially given that we still have an acting Secretary of Defense. And so, like, just how far out over your skis can you get if you're an undersecretary or an assistant secretary, you know, like, who's, you know, really what is the wire diagram, both for, like, communicating those policies, which is the first part of that, but also imposing penalties for people who get out of line. I think that this is, it can be real sporty. Meanwhile, our friends in North Korea are going to meet us in Vietnam. Is that what we learned last week?
Yes.
There's going to be Nuclear Summit 2, Electric Boogaloo. Is that what we're looking forward to? I mean, I've both had trouble following the plot to this, and then I realize it's because there is no plot line to the U.S.-North Korea negotiations and what's supposed to happen at the end of the month in Vietnam.
That's right. I mean, we're meeting again.
Okay, good.
I mean, I think the thing is, we're meeting again. We're
at the. I mean, President Trump and Kim are going to meet in Vietnam face to face again.
Correct.
Right. I mean, I think the key here is to keep expectations decently low, and I think that in some ways, occasionally the president has done that. Maybe not on purpose, just by implying that maybe they're not going to give up nuclear weapons right away, or maybe they're not, you know, completely not a threat anymore, which is. Both of those things are accurate, if not consistent with his original statements on this issue. And to make sure that we do not give away something truly significant for getting absolutely nothing. And given that, I think probably you guys may have seen in the last couple of days, the United States just finally signed another agreement with the South Koreans in terms of the presence of U.S. forces in South Korea and the arrangements about who would be paying for such. I would be very worried that this is on the table for this administration to either as a something to give the North Koreans that we would take either a lot of U.S. forces or all of U.S. forces out of South Korea as some kind of bargaining chip in this process. And in my mind, I mean, first of all, I don't think it's a good idea no matter what. But in my mind, we are nowhere near close to that in terms of things that we should possibly have on the table for them in any way.
Yeah, I think I have a slightly... I think the Trump administration's approach to these negotiations has been to have these presidential meetings to say that progress is being made with not a ton of substantive changes to what we are actually doing vis-a-vis the North Koreans. Now, obviously, that can change. And we could certainly, you know, we certainly did cancel some exercises in the past and training missions with the South Koreans. And that could certainly happen again. But I would be interested to try to understand better if there's any plan for how we are going to like implement or make progress on anything that is discussed at the leadership level after any of these talks, or if that's just like we've given up on that and now we just like meet periodically with Kim Jong and the president, President Trump, and then we kind of say that things are getting better and then do that again, rinse and repeat in a bunch of months. And that seems to be our current approach.
Yeah, I mean, Steve Biegun was in the region, and he's our high-level negotiator, and he met with Kim Un-chol, who's the kind of the senior representative on the North Korea side, and the readout was that nothing was agreed to, and they agreed to meet again. And so that is, you know, 3 weeks ahead of the next, you know, chief of state summit. They're still... you know, we're basically still getting worked on the diplomatic side. And so on the plus side, I guess they finally met with Steve Biegun. That has not been a common occurrence over the last 6 or 7 months, you know, since the Singapore summit. So maybe there's an opportunity to get some pre-prepared text or other kind of minor things agreed to. I've definitely seen speculation to Lauren's point that there might be an agreement on a formal conclusion to the peace treaty or a formal peace treaty ending the Korean War agreed to in Vietnam. I think, Lauren, that sets the stage for the kinds of troop discussions that, you know, you're talking about. I just worry, you know, whether we're all watching the same chess game or if there's pieces being moved and we're not fully appreciating the implications.
Yeah, I mean, I think that to me is a not illogical next step for the U.S. to offer that up, or the U.S. with the South Koreans to offer that up. if we are seeing progress from the North Koreans on following up on their prior commitments to actually release a list of all of their nuclear, biochemical, missile, other weapons that they have, that has been part of the discussion before. We have not gotten, so far as we can tell, we've gotten nowhere near close to that. And if we give something else away in order to get something that has already been promised, I mean, that's not exactly operating at the top of our negotiations game, though I suppose if, you know, things could be worse, I guess, if in terms of how President Trump conducts negotiations, but that's still not a great model to have for future negotiation steps here.
And I think it's helpful, and maybe this is a point that we might shift to talking about the China trade talks, which are also coming up.
Yes.
It's an interesting point to compare the negotiation styles and the underlying process and structure that are going on with the Korea talks versus the China trade talks. So for folks who don't remember, we were in a tit for tat tariff slash trade tax war with China. And in particular, we had levied trade taxes on a large portion of Chinese goods, which was costing billions of dollars, but also increasing the price of Chinese goods to American consumers. We agreed to a little bit of a moratorium and to try to have a negotiation with China covering a couple of things, one big one being intellectual property and how in particular China treats those intellectual properties. So the trade talks to deal with that are starting on Monday. But there's been like a whole kind of substantive process. So the deputy trade reps are meeting. There's going to be high level principal talks towards the end of the week. Then towards later in February, there is a meeting between President Xi and President Trump. So there's like a whole negotiation process where a bunch of options are going to be worked through at the working group level, then brought to the principals. They're going to agree on a small, the current reporting at least suggests, agree on a small number of options and then present those to the leaders to see if we can avoid or reverse course on some of these trade talks, which sounds like, I mean, conditional on starting a trade war, sounds like a pretty reasonable approach.
Maybe we should send them some processed Valentines.
I was like, hey, this sounds like a legit thing.
What about White House mayhem?
Well, White House mayhem this week just kind of checks a lot of my favorite process boxes to discuss. First, we can mention briefly the State of the Union, which was last week, a bit delayed as usual, in which we learned a couple of things. Nothing too terribly surprising in terms of President Trump's own perspective on foreign policy. I think my favorite line of the evening was that great powers do not fight endless wars, which I think that, you know, most people listening would be kind of like, yeah, that I'm with you on that. However, great powers probably also don't like mindlessly decide to intervene in Venezuela for no particular reason with militarily. But like that's a whole separate issue.
Also, I think actually great powers fight some pretty long wars, actually, right? over history. But regardless,
also because they can. Very,
right. It's interesting.
Yeah. It was a lot of the America's first greatest hits that we saw over and over again. There was not a good rationalization of what exactly is our Middle East policy that I think a lot of people would have desired but should not have really anticipated to be coming out of this speech. Did you guys have any other favorite moments from the evening?
You know, there was a lot of doom and gloom about risk to the border, which I think we all expected. But there was a surprisingly, I thought, long section on human trafficking that just got like sort of lifted in there. And I was like, okay, all right, we're doing human trafficking now. None of the stuff you're proposing actually seems to deal with it. But cool, we'll talk about that too. So I was, you know, I saw some diversification in the various threats that could be coming across the border. No mention on how they're going to unify the children they separated, but I guess we didn't expect that either.
Have you guys seen the theory that a lot of what President Trump seems to talk about with regard to border threats is from a movie?
No.
Not actually from any intelligence briefings, but it's from the movie, I believe it's called Sicario.
Oh, really?
Yes.
With Emily Blunt?
Yes. That like the you know, the women tied up in duct tape and things like that. There's not actually any evidence of this that we, or at least that it's prevalent in any way, but it does seem to be a plot point that comes up quite often in Sicario. So things that he has mentioned are pretty thematically related to that. So at least I suppose that he's getting it from somewhere and not completely making it up out of his head. But I was entertained by that, if not slightly disturbed. But it did make me wonder if there are other opportunities to insert certain policy ideas into the president's mind.
We could certainly come up with a whole pop culture, you know, viewing list to help shape the president's appreciation for things. Although exactly. Hollywood does a kind of mediocre job on many of these topics.
is there a movie about the value of alliances in NATO? No, not really. Not a good one anyway.
Not a good one. We could go ask Julie Smith for suggestions.
So the president, in the context of the speech and other remarks that he's made this week, has also again referenced that he is going to continue to make our defense budget the biggest, baddest, best in the whole world. People may remember this part of the story from late last year, where he originally said he wanted to cut the defense budget for a little while back to $700 billion. The story appears to be that it's going to be back around $730, $750 billion, with a little asterisk next to the budget. Aaron, what makes this budget different than all other budgets?
Well, so we're still subject to the Budget Control Act, which was passed, as you know, I think basically in 2010. And so we are, or sorry, 2012. And so those caps put a top line kind of limit on what should be available in the defense budget. And I forget what the exact cap for this year is supposed to be, but I think it's somewhere around $525 or $530 billion, which isn't nothing, but it's a lot lower than last year's top line figure. And so the question is, how do we, you know, get the defense budget that the department actually wants and that, you know, I don't know, bipartisan panels, in fact, think that we need while still dealing with this budget cap? Please recall that if we violate the Budget Control Act caps without some other bipartisan deal, which, of course, is what we had last year, that triggers the sequester. So it'll trigger automatic 10% cuts across all of the accounts, which is a really, really painful and deeply a strategic way to manage any department, much less the Defense Department. So there's a lot of pressure to avoid the sequester, but so that leads to a lot of chicanery, mostly because there's basically zero expectation that there'll be a bipartisan budget deal available this year because the Democrats control the House and they're not interested in increasing dramatically defense spending unless they get concomitant raisins in the domestic spending for programs that they care a little bit more about. So what they've done is, in the parlance of the defense budget geeks, shoved a shit ton of money into OCO. That's the Overseas Contingent Operations account. What do we think that number is going to be, Lauren? Do you remember?
I believe it is going to be $170 billion, something around that.
$170 billion in the OCO slush fund.
Which is about $100 billion more than it was last year. And I will remind, as Aaron just implied, this money is for usually overseas contingency operations, not just for like day-to-day budget stuff. And we appear to be, in most cases, actually withdrawing from a lot of these operations.
Or at least reducing the operational tempo, right? So the idea that we need, you know, 2 to 3 times more money for the overseas account than we did last year, I mean, is obviously laughable kind of on its face. And so there's pretty low expectations that this will survive first contact in the House, but it is a very amusing situation, especially given Mick Mulvaney's role in trying to get rid of the OCO accounts before, and now he's going to have to defend this as the director of the Office of Management and Budget.
That's what I was going to say. So, I mean, this shoving a bunch of money in the OCO slush fund is like not a new strategy here.
Not a new trick. No. Time-honored tradition.
What makes it funny is the guy who has been calling out this trick and complaining about it is now literally submitting the largest slush fund we have seen in some time to the Congress. So that's, you know, a new twist. This season's exciting.
I would add the further asterisk that we actually are still on a continuing resolution from last year for, you know, all those government departments that were shut down before will shut down again on Friday if we don't either get another CR or some other bill. So we're still looking for some sort of negotiations, I guess, some sort of face-saving deal on the border wall so that we can get permanent appropriations for, you know, the minor departments like Homeland Security, Justice, Internal Revenue Service, Parks, you know, Interior, all of that good stuff. So that'll happen this week as well.
My theory on this is actually that there will be quite a bit of sound and fury in both the House and probably also the Senate when this actually pops. However, because neither the Democrats nor the Republicans in either the House and the Senate have their shit together in terms of what they think the defense budget should be, I think that it's possible we may just eat this in order to not have to have a real defense budget debate, because Democrats are not on the same page. Republicans are not on the same page in a lot of cases. And this is not necessarily a winning political fight for anybody to make over the next year to have the party prominently featured in the who either supports the defense budget the most or who supports a corrupt, bloated, whatever over interventionist budget the most, which depending on how you want to characterize it. To close out, I just want to mention briefly, there is an amazing publication that has come out in the last week on ProPublica detailing the mishap sounds like a terrible word, the accident that took place in 2017 on the USS Fitzgerald that we have talked about a couple of times on this episode, or sorry, on this show, and that goes into just incredibly beautifully written detail with really, really great design and storytelling to talk about how this incident happened, where seven sailors' lives were lost, the various components of leadership failures, as well as kind of systemic and equipment and other failures, training that was really at a huge gap in of the Seventh Fleet overall. It just goes through a lot of it in a way that I think pulls the story together that in a way that has not been done before. It is separately generated an interesting debate online as to whose true responsibility was this. Was it the responsibility and the fault of the commanding officer of the Fitzgerald, which is where obviously the Navy is ultimately placing a lot of blame? Or is it more in the systemic failures of the Navy overall, the Seventh Fleet, or even the overarching guidance of the Secretary of Defense, which placed great emphasis on presence missions, particularly in the South China Sea and in the Asia region overall?
Yeah, and just like one more plug for that ProPublica report, which I think, as Lauren said, is extremely well written, which is it has sections that sort of help make sense of a number of the different issues that are underlying the debate here. So there is an issue of training and manning for those interested in the personnel pieces and what the trade-offs between having experienced and inexperienced folks in some key roles on the ships are, but a whole host of things related to equipment and maintenance, the roles of budget, as well as leadership failure. So it's a little bit of a slog to make your way through, but it is well worth it if for only to better understand sort of the different factors that can cause these really tragic accidents.
So on happier notes, Aaron, do you have any pop culture for us?
I saw the Lego Movie 2 with my nieces this weekend.
As you do.
Awesome.
As I definitely do. I mean, I'll be honest. I love the Lego Movie. That might be a little bit surprising. I love everything about the original Lego Movie. I have to say this one's not quite as good, but like it mostly works. And so if you have either young people to take with you or just a cold beer to bring to the theater, you will very much enjoy, I think, Lego Movie 2. Lauren, did you successfully binge Discovery of Witches?
So I've only seen the first two episodes because I'm trying to save it and savor it over time. But I have to tell you guys, Matthew Good is the best vampire I have ever seen. He's really good. He's beautiful. And he does this thing with his face when he's like turning into like crazy vampire mode. You're like, oh my God, you are totally a vampire. And the woman who plays Diana could not be Mary Sue if she tried. Like her skin and her hair and her eyes and just like everything about her, she's just looking up adoringly at him being like, oh, you could totally kill me, but that's so lovely. Like, it's just great. And I can't wait to watch two more episodes tonight. And like, it's really, I think, going to keep me going for like the next few weeks of this crazy, ridiculous, awful weather.
I'm really impressed at your self-control.
I was really hoping that the series would sort of resolve some of the issues with the books. I'm not 100% convinced that it has, but it cast Matthew Good. And so I have more patience for the flaws of the series than
exactly.
I had the patience for the flaw of the book.
Also, It has Alex Kingston in it, the woman from ER from ages ago playing Sarah. And God, she's great. I love her so much.
Well, that's a good dose of pop culture. We'll see what else we all get up to as we're all snowbound and or traveling over these next couple of weeks. So thanks, everyone, for joining us. See you in a bit.